Okay, we're going to take your phone calls now with Robert Schock. I'm George Norrie, and we're back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And the Parapsychology Revolution, is the book out in bookstores now, Robert?
It is. It is. It came out, I think, officially January 31st, so hopefully people can buy it everywhere.
Timing is perfect.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But I really do. I'll plug the book here, I guess. I really do believe in this book and more so the subject matter. That's why I believe in the book. Like I said before, it's something that I got sort of pulled into. I'm an academic. I'm a conventional academic. I still see myself that way. And, you know, maybe it would have been easier for me to have said this is just a bunch of nonsense and dismiss it, but I looked at it seriously, and there's absolutely something there, and we need to address it, I think, as collectively, as a society, as a people. And it's really, in my opinion, it's really worldview-altering.
Are you surprised, Robert, at the outcome when you did your own homework?
Yes, absolutely, because... And I'll tell you, it's very similar to my research on the Sphinx. When I first got pulled into the Sphinx arguments, I thought I would go over there as a geologist, figure out why these crazy people who thought the Sphinx might be older and there might be a more ancient civilization, all that. I thought, well, you know, it should be easy enough. Couple of days' work, I'll prove why they're wrong, why the conventional academics are right. Didn't work out that way for the Sphinx. I went into the paranormal the same way, thinking, you know, it's got to be a lot of nonsense. You know, all I was really familiar with was the, how should we say, the general popular literature. Then I was just absolutely amazed when I got into it, how much scientific research there's been done, very serious scientific research. And it's now, my question is, why is this being ignored by the conventional academic and scientific community? There's really... I hate to use the term conspiracy, but in a way there's a conspiracy. I don't know if it's a planned conspiracy, but I guess, you know, people are just so set in their ways and they have such strong, really held beliefs that are incompatible with the paranormal. They don't want to change their beliefs and they'll debunk, they'll dismiss, they'll ostracize, they'll make fun of paranormal phenomena and those who study it without ever objectively looking at the evidence. And
all right,
just, well, that's wrong.
Let's go to the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Southern Ohio.
Okay, go ahead. Thanks.
I'm a paleontologist and I've been digging in the Ordovician for about 20 years now.
Oh, wow.
And on many occasions, before we find something, we know it's going to be there. Or sometimes we'll be kind of attracted to a certain area, and you'll find something, not just anything, something significant. And Christmas Day, my husband says, I think I'm going to go out digging today. And I said, you know, I think you're going to find something today. And I just had this feeling, and it was there, you know, something really nice. So in a way, to use your title of your book, The Voices of the Rocks, I think they do speak to us.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm a geologist, and actually, I don't know if you realize, or you may realize if you read my work, I'm trained as a vertebrate paleontologist. I worked did a lot of work in the Paleocene Eocene.
Beautiful.
And I know exactly what you're talking about. And I mean,
good. That's what I wanted to know.
Exactly. I know exactly what you're saying. And, you know, people that haven't experienced that, they can just sort of dismiss it as, you know, nonsense or bunk, but you and I know it's real.
It is. And I have another question that I hope you can get into, and that is I researched the Simulacra Mountain in Egypt as well. Are you familiar with the images of the ancient gods that are seen in the Mountain of Thebes?
Yes.
And what do you think of that?
That's another complex subject.
It is.
Because you also have something very similar at a place called Marcahuasi in Peru, which I've written about somewhat.
Let's describe what they look like to you two, if
essentially, what we have in both cases are cliffs, rock formations, that type of thing, that look like, in some cases, humans, in some cases, animals. You tell me if I'm describing it correctly.
It's perfect.
I'm sorry?
Perfect.
Yeah, yeah. And the real question is, are these very ancient carvings, are we just looking at essentially like clouds in the sky and seeing shapes and seeing anthropomorphic figures? And it's a very difficult, complex question because, you know, if they are ancient carvings, they're incredibly old. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, therefore, very weathered, very difficult to tell whether they've been, to see any original workings, that type of thing on them. But I don't dismiss them at all at this point. I hate to be non-definitive, but I won't give a definitive answer when I, that's just my nature, when I don't have enough evidence. In this case, I think we just need to look at them. Mm-hmm. You know, they require a lot more research, but they're absolutely fascinating.
They are. I tend to think that maybe they're both, that maybe some of them are carved and some of them are natural, and that mythology and the belief has come about from these images that are in nature.
Exactly.
That's why temples are where they are.
Exactly. I think that's very well said, because that's really the conclusion I've been coming to also, both in Egypt and the ones I was mentioning in Peru, because in Peru, for instance, very clearly you have situations where you've got absolutely man-made structures, little temples, little seating arrangements, that type of thing, in relation to the simulacra. So they're clearly being acknowledged in ancient times.
Acknowledged and revered.
Exactly. And you have the same thing in Egypt, too, of course, with the placement of tombs and temples. Yeah.
There's even another question that I can't even answer. What do they have? Spirit? Do they have an essence of their own?
Well, I was going to say the traditional answer is yes, that they do. And I, you know, really, what do you call spirit? What do you call essence? Something that we are finding is a lot of these places that are seen as sort of sacred spots or sacred sites, they do have, I'll use the term subtle energy, and I don't mean that in any kind of flaky way, but, you know, there are energies, electromagnetic, geomagnetic, et cetera, that you can actually measure at some of these places that are different than you have elsewhere. So, I mean, it seems that the ancient people were clued into this, and they somehow sensed that.
And we have since lost it.
And we've since lost that. And also, I think, tie in with this is you have revered spots, sacred sites, whatever you want to call it, and you find consistently at such spots that people were returning to them over and over again. So even in recent times, and for me, recent is the last 2,000 years, you have Christian churches built on what are much earlier, very ancient sacred sites.
Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with Robert Schock. Hi there.
Hello there.
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm here.
It's you. Go ahead. I got to disconnect you.
Guy from Huntington Beach, California.
Guy, if you don't go, I'm going to have to disconnect you.
Oh, if I don't go, okay.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
All right. Yes, Dr. Schock, how are you tonight?
Good, very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, as it turns out, I didn't know you were going to be a guest on tonight, and it just so happens I went into the bookstore last night and picked up your book.
Oh, wonderful. I like to hear that. Thank you.
So it is out there. You did get a sale.
Great.
That's good.
And it's good to know it's in bookstores now. Excellent.
Yeah. I have two questions. One, how have your colleagues, your academic colleagues, reacted to the publishing of this book? And the second question, I'll just slip this in and then I'll get off the air. But can you relate some of your own personal experiences? I know this has been mostly a literature search for you and Logan.
Yeah.
But say, for example, could you go into a little more depth about your little poltergeist encounter?
Oh, okay.
You
saw that in there already. Yeah, because I really didn't get into it in this book, but I will admit I've had some of my own paranormal experiences or observed directly paranormal experiences.
Based on doing the research, is that what brought it along?
Based, not just based on, I think part of it may actually be based on doing the research. And something that's very important and comes up in certain aspects of the serious paranormal literature consistently is the concept, which many people are aware of synchronicity or coincidence. Many cases, and I found that in this research, that in many times, I'm looking for something literature-wise or whatnot, and I'll just hit upon it. It seems anomalously by coincidence, but it's like it was intended to be. Or I'll be thinking about a certain subject, and then I'll actually experience something that ties right in. And you know, when you start looking at it and you look at the literature, you look at serious, again, studies of such things, this seems to have to do with, a certain ability, should we say, to shape the world around us, which is actually part of the paranormal. So sort of inducing, if you would, or changing probabilities. One way to look at the paranormal, if you get into various theories of it, is that it actually changes probabilities of incidents happening, essentially by injecting information or consciousness into a system. I don't mean to sound too abstract. But for instance, while I was working on this book, I did observe a firsthand experience of a poltergeist incident. Someone who I think was the agent of that incident. We didn't talk about poltergeist incidents. Most people probably have at least some concept of what they are. A typical poltergeist incident is objects falling off a shelf or things flying around a room, that type of thing.
Sure.
Classically, they're attributed to ghosts in a loose sense. All the evidence indicates that in genuine poltergeist incidents, there's some kind of agent or a person that they're centered on. And to really oversimplify, and we talk about this in more detail in the book and have a wonderful article by William Roll, one of the great authorities on poltergeists, contemporary authorities. But to oversimplify, essentially you can think of it as someone who gets incredibly emotional about something. Usually it's unresolved conflicts, that type of thing. And this starts manifesting itself as spontaneous psychokinesis. So objects around them, without them ever touching them, totally by paranormal means, falling off shelves, things breaking, et cetera, et cetera. That's a typical poltergeist incident, and I had the opportunity, actually, as I was working on this book, I was around someone who, should we say, is fairly emotionally charged, and sure enough, I observed what I'll call a minor poltergeist incident, a book falling off a shelf. The subject of the book was relevant to the discussion at the time. I'm very skeptical about such things, but I'll tell you, I saw this directly with my own eyes. I went into it in great detail. There was no one close to the object. It jumped. It did not just fall by gravity. I witnessed it directly. And what's more important to me is not even my own evidence, but the evidence I had, what I saw myself. And, it was spontaneous. I wasn't expecting this at the time. But then when I look at what I saw, I compare that to well-documented examples in the literature. Again, we come back to it fit a very similar pattern. And this is what you expect of genuine phenomena in nature. So to me as a scientist, that becomes very compelling.
To the phones we go, wild card line.
Yeah, I was going to say, in answer to his first question.
Oh, I almost forgot the first one.
The book just
his colleagues,
came,
yeah.
The
what
book
it is,
just
what...
came out. We'll see how my colleagues react. I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Simple enough. Now, Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. This is Chris in South Texas. And Dr. Shock, it's a real honor to talk to you tonight.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I just wanted to know, do you use divining rods in your work, or if you don't, are you going to?
Divining rods are really interesting. In fact, one of the great early psychical researchers, Sir William Barrett, And actually on the Coast to Coast website, they posted a photo of him that I sent in. He was an expert in divining rods. He was a physicist, very well-known physicist in his time. He lived the late 19th, early 20th century, was very skeptical about them, did a massive study of them, which turned into a several hundred-page monograph, and came to the conclusion that, yeah, there's something to it. And in answer to your question, I've used them. I've experimented a little bit with divining rods. I've been around some other people who have used them. And, I mean, it's a really very interesting phenomenon and something I'm planning to do in the future in the context of archaeological, geological sites, is try to run some, again, I'm a scientist, run some blind studies of divining rod predictions. So that's one thing I'd like to do. The second, of course, is to simply use them to try to locate otherwise unknown objects.
We've got a guest who comes on.
That type of thing. So answer to the question is yes, it's fascinating.
Raymond Grace is one of our guests who swears by these rods.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And again, I think one thing we didn't touch on, but I think it's an important point, is that not everyone has paranormal abilities to the same extent. At least that's my opinion based on the research I've done so far. Or at least they haven't developed them to the same extent. Even with people who use divining rods or remote viewing, that type of thing, sometimes there are people who are very good at, say, for instance, finding water, but not at finding mineral deposits. And you might have someone else that can find mineral deposits very well, but not water. Something as simple as that.
Next up, East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Jim from Cape Girardeau.
Hey, Jim. Missouri. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Dr. Shock, it's a pleasure to talk to you tonight, sir.
Thank you very much
for taking my call. A year and a half ago or so, I saw an interview with you, and they were talking about the temple underwater in Japan.
Right.
And you had said that you felt it was a natural structure.
Right.
I was wondering, with all the right angles and the way that those stones, they look almost obviously cut.
Oh.
Wouldn't the water round those edges off, the currents, wouldn't the running water make those smoother than what they are?
I absolutely understand what you're saying. And let me just clarify, or let me fill in for the listening audience. You're talking specifically about Yanaguni in Japan, and it's a magnificent underwater structure that I've been there on several occasions, dived it numerous times. And I'll tell you, from the photographs before I went over there, I was absolutely, absolutely convinced, but I thought there was very high probability it was a human man-made carved structure, because it does have these very regular patterns. But what I found is that when I looked at it as a geologist, and I would love it to be a human man-made structure for other reasons, because I'm interested in ancient cultures, et cetera, but it turns out it wasn't. So I had to call it as it was. But in answer to your question, you do get rounding on the edges, but the rocks are actually very hard, very resistant to erosion, except at the joints where they break off.
Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, Jerry Smith joins us. He's an author. He's a lecturer. We're going to talk about HAARP, chemtrails, and weather warfare on our next Coast to Coast show. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest Robert Shock, and your phone calls. We'll go to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hello there. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Robert.
Hello.
How are y'all doing?
Hello.
Hi. I had, a little question on anything on your shadow people, if you've experienced anything with your research on shadow people.
Shadow people. Okay. I know what you're talking about. I believe I know what you're talking about. In fact, this goes back to the 19th century. Actually, there's a very famous book back then called Shadowlands, talking about shadow people. And it's a fascinating subject. I mean, exactly who are the shadow people or what they are. They've been interpreted different ways, both, you know, discarnate entities, maybe a different dimension. It's something I really don't get heavily into this book. And as I was saying before, it's probably the subject or going to be part of another book in the future. How are you using the term shadow people?
Well, I've heard it more on negative terms. And mm-hmm. the first time that I ever saw anything, and I was, I guess, in a, you know, spiritualist church, and I saw, you know, it's a shadow behind
right,
this
exactly.
man.
Right, exactly.
And it was the reading he was doing, and I tuned into that, and I couldn't really concentrate on what he was saying.
Right.
And then I've noticed, like, if there's a speaker, like a real, anyone who's really, excuse me, passionate about what they're speaking about,
mm-hmm.
Especially in a large group of people, that I can see behind them as if that's their teacher.
Right.
And I've actually seen it. There was a man called Colin Lambert.
Uh-huh.
And from New Zealand. Really a very interesting healer. And I could actually see like a Chinese man behind him. So it started taking a little more form.
Uh-huh.
And then, let's see, I was at Chris Howard's, like a hypnosis session.
Mm-hmm.
And he did and I'm a hypnotherapist, so I was right before I got involved with it. And I could see three teachers behind him.
Oh, wow.
But under hypnosis, I could see them very clearly.
Uh-huh.
And so I've always heard that, you know, people are kind of scared of it. And, you know, I don't see spirits.
Right.
I just spent, you know, I had a near death at 13, so I spent my whole life finding every tool you can speak of, you know.
Right.
And so I'm not really mastering anything, but when I need the tool, I can pull it, whether it be dowsing or
right.
whatever. Now, another question I had was on automatic writing.
Right.
Anything there?
Well, I mean, automatic writing is something that's been studied. It was very, how should I say, popular in the late 1800s, early 1900s, especially as a way of, you know, the classic thing was as a medium. You know this, but
it's like a tool. It's like
a tool to speak with the deceased, the departed, that type of thing. But in other cases, people would use automatic writing simply to essentially get what I would call telepathic information. There's many instances where people write automatically. They wouldn't even know what they were writing until after they themselves read it. There were several well-documented cases where you'd have an automatic writer. They would carry on a conversation with people as their hand was doing this. And it seemed to simply be a tool, at least one way to view it from my perspective. My hypothesis is that it was a tool to bring to consciousness essentially unconscious information, in some cases acquired paranormally. One thing about the paranormal, I think, in my opinion, is that we probably, many people, receive a lot more information than they're ever aware of, than that's ever brought to consciousness. So I've seen automatic writing as really a way to bring this to a conscious state or to bring it out.
Let's go to our next wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hello there. Good morning.
Good morning. Good evening. Dr. Shock and George, how are you?
Oh, good, very thanks. Good. Thank you.
Dr. Shock, this is Matthew from Team Atlantis.
Oh, hey. How are you doing?
How are you, my
friend?
Good
to hear you.
How far you've come, my friend. I have to say, as somebody who, you know, I guess when we first met about 9 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
You were always obviously a fair-minded skeptic. I'd like to, you know, to say, you know, I had some influence on opening your mind a little.
Oh, I'm sure you did. Absolutely. Absolutely. But I tried to be a fair-minded skeptic.
Absolutely.
I hope you know that. And
absolutely.
I tried to call it, and I think this is, for me, this is an important personal point, is I try to call it the way I see it. So, you know, as much as I'd like something to maybe be one thing or the other, I don't try to fake it. I don't try to manipulate data to make it what I want it to be.
Which is why the point about Yanaguni is so interesting, because while I still have, you know, I think I may lean a little bit more in the direction of possible modification theories and so forth, I think your willingness to, you know, to stand up to, you know, people that, you know, might so desperately, you know, need it to be something, you know, out of the ordinary or man-made, that, you know, that just shows even through today, as much as you've gotten your feet deeply, deeply in, you know, this new topic, this new area of, you know, psychical-related research, You know, you're a geologist, and you know that one of the top in the world is not the top, and you've maintained your scientific rigor, which is something that is so critically needed in this area of research.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You know, and having read, and, you know, all I can say is, Dr. Schock, in future when we have our next conversation, we'll have to get into some of the more interesting experiences that I've had as well that
absolutely
will feed into this new area that you've now opened yourself up to.
Oh, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
I applaud you on the new book, and I can't wait to get a hold of it.
Great. Well, thank you. Gosh, it's good to hear your voice.
What a great call. It's nice to get those once in a while, Robert.
Exactly.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Hi, this is Steve from Costa Mesa.
Hey, Stephen.
I wanted to tell you guys a story about our dog, Huggy.
Huggy, okay.
Oh, wonderful.
I don't know which term you put, whether it's psychic or what, but I'll just tell you the story real quick. My wife and I tried for an early retirement. It didn't last, but we spent two really nice years up in Sequoia National Forest. And Huggy was, I don't know, maybe 10 at the time. My wife moved back down to the San Fernando Valley here in California about 6 months before I did. When she would come up on the weekends to visit, usually she'd arrive right about dark or so, and about 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour or so before she'd get there, Huggy would meander his way over to the door and push the screen door open, go down the bottom of the stairs and sit there. And this would only happen once a week, but regular as whatever day that she was coming, whether it was a Friday night or a Saturday morning or whenever it was, he knew, and he would go sit there. And sure enough, you know, she'd show up. I would know that she was going to be there soon because as soon as he went down there, she'd show up in a half an hour or so. And this happened for about 3 or 4 months. And then the last month that we were up there, just before I moved back down to the valley, we were staying at her mom's house till we got situated. And so she had Huggy the last month. And one time I paid him, more than once, but this one time in particular, I paid an unexpected visit. I drove down there on a Saturday afternoon, and they were all sitting around in the house, and my wife didn't know I was coming. And Huggy all of a sudden just moseyed over to the door and planted himself right in front of the front door. And she walked over, and she knew because we had talked about this. It was just too unusual not to discuss it. She said, "No, Papa's not coming. He's not coming. You know, come back in." But he'd stay there. And then he all of a sudden got real excited and started dancing in front of the door. So she walked over from the dining room, walked over there and opened the front door. And there I was walking up the front walkway. And this happened a couple of times. And we were, you know, he was real close. We took him everywhere with us. And it was just something that was pretty remarkable, you know. Go ahead.
Wow, I was going to say that's a wonderful story. That's a real wonderful story, and it's wonderful from two aspects. Just from my perspective, it's just sort of a wonderful story unto itself. But it's so classic. Also,
yeah.
Like I was saying before, it fits the pattern of the classic stories. And I mean, clearly, I think you would agree something's happening there.
Well, you know, it's just a subject. I mean, it's like I don't need convincing. I mean,
exactly.
It's just something I know.
You know, exactly. When you have experiences like that, you know.
Right.
And there's no substitute for having that firsthand type of experience.
Right. Well, thanks a lot for taking my call.
Oh, it's wonderful. Thank you very much.
Next up, let's go east of the Rockies. Hello there.
Hello, George. This is Dan, the blind man of the angels of Joplin. How you doing,
Joplin,
buddy?
Good, Danny.
Hey, I got two things here. First of all, many years ago, I was staring into a direction while playing saxophone in a parade band because I felt someone was staring at me. And it turns out that this man, he turned to his friend. He says, "I've been trying to stare that sax player down for the last mile and a half." And my friend said, "Oh, he's blind." He says, "How can he know that I'm staring at him?" He says, "Oh, he's psychic." So we all became best friends.
Wow.
And then that has happened to me hundreds of times in my life. And then another thing that has happened to me is, for example, George, I knew that, you know, when you went to Austin and Tom had to help you, you know, because you fell.
I fell into that
hole. I knew that you fell and that you embarrassed yourself and that Tommy was there to help you. You see what I mean?
The truth be known, Dan, I think Tommy pushed me.
Well, what if...
No, I'm kidding.
You're joking right now.
Kidding.
Yeah. Now, also, have you ever heard of people being thousands of miles away from their relatives and perceiving of emergency surgery, and then they come home and they find out? Because my Aunt Montine, I was at a concert in California, and I felt that she was still alive, but that a machine was moving her blood through her body. Mm-hmm. And when I left, she was fine. And I got back home, and I called, and my mom said, yeah, Montine went in just for a routine checkup, and they rushed her into bypass surgery that afternoon.
Wow. No, absolutely. I've heard of things like that before, which is no way to belittle what you're saying, but to confirm.
Uh-huh.
And if I understand correctly, you are, in fact, blind.
Yeah, actually,
yeah.
What it was,
sure
was I had sight, like if you put stuff up to my face,
mm-hmm.
like until I was 5 years old,
mm-hmm.
I saw shapes and shadows and colors.
Yeah.
And then when that disappeared, the inner space came out.
Right.
And what happened was, is that I started perceiving shapes and everything in continual motion. And what was so funny about it, I told my dad about this when I was 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, that's like Rube Goldberg. Don't be like him. He was a genius. He was never practical. But I knew that it was so neat. And I never shut it out.
No, that's
And I
smart.
Use it. That's why I can communicate with graphic artists.
Exactly.
And I use telepathy on stage.
Exactly.
And I also use my hands to scan synthesizers, because
mm-hmm.
a lot of times I don't have chance for people to, tell me what the knobs are.
Right.
And I have found that the Moogs, the old Moog synthesizers, were the most compatible with psychics.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Because there's certain brands, like you can scan your hands over them.
Right.
And you can tell, even before you turn them on, that they're lousy pieces of equipment.
Right.
And so I've done, I use a lot of telepathy in my recording that I've done.
Yeah.
And
exactly. And I was going to say, it makes perfect sense to me that you have been you've heightened those abilities. I mean, I don't want to sound the wrong way, but in a way compensating for what you don't have. Does that make sense to you?
Well, that happens a lot, though, doesn't it,
yeah.
Robert?
Yeah, exactly. So I think this is just a wonderful, I'm sorry you're blind, but a wonderful, classic case.
Let's go to West of the Rockies, and thanks for that call.
Yeah, so that was wonderful. Thank you very much for sharing that.
You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Don in Salem, Oregon.
Hey, hello, Don.
Hi, George and Robert. And George, I told Tommy it's good to hear you guys both feeling well.
Oh, yeah, we
and
bounced
Robert,
back quickly.
I had 9 million questions for you, but you being a geologist, what do you think about the petroglyphs in the ocean off of Okinawa?
Oh, off of Okinawa,
yeah.
the ones that are right, versus the Yanaguni ones.
Yeah,
I think, I've dived some of those. You've got a different situation. We were talking about the Yanaguni ones earlier.
Right.
And the ones that we've got off of Okinawa are different. They're sort of arranged rock structures, that type of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, I think some of those are more convincing as artificial structures, as man-made structures.
Right.
And we know that whole part of the world was has been inhabited, of course, for thousands and thousands of years, and you've had rises in sea levels, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to interject, we didn't really talk that much about Yanaguni, but even on Yanaguni, there is clear evidence of human habitation in very ancient times, despite the fact that, in my opinion, the structures everyone focuses on, I think, are natural. But I think even ancient humans were acknowledging those natural structures.
Okay, can I interject one more question? I know you guys are
kind of
short. Robert, what do you think about Zahi Hawass's opinion about the Egyptians built the pyramids, when you're into the paranormal or the UFO theories, whatever, what do you think about that?
The classic explanation for the pyramids is that they were big old tombs for pharaohs of the dynastic period,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's either oversimplification if you want to use those terms, or it's just plain wrong. What I mean by that is, yeah, sure, they may have been used as tombs for pharaohs later, but just like a cathedral where people are buried, you wouldn't say a cathedral is primarily a tomb. Furthermore, there's very clear evidence, and I go into this in my various books and whatnot, that the Great Pyramid in particular, and I believe the other pyramids too, they're built on earlier structures, or at least their sites are earlier. The Great Pyramid itself was built over a very long period of time, the subterranean chamber in the base of it or underneath it.
Well, they put it back
way further in time. I mean, essentially, the conventional Egyptological view is, should we say, oversimplification.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Have a good night.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, too. A few more moments ago, probably not enough to get another phone call in, Robert. So I would like you to let us know, once and for all, what are you doing next?
Well, as far as the paranormal goes, a couple of issues that we've even talked about today, I'm very interested in the survival issue, the whole issue of life beyond the grave, if you want to put it that way, something we purposefully did not delve into in any great detail in Parapsychology Revolution, although we certainly touched on and we talked about reincarnation a bit. But, you know, there's just so much in this area, and we felt that was better to at least focus on this life first and paranormal abilities in this life as a foundation for other things. So somewhere I'm going is the survival issue, concerned about that. Cosmic influences on paranormal abilities, consciousness that gets ties right in with the conference I was talking about.
That's all
earlier.
Fair enough. Robert, we're out of time. The book, The Parapsychology Revolution, it's out there right now. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.